morning. We have visitors with us, and we appreciate you very much. We're going to be studying in just a moment in Judges, the 16th chapter. Beginning in Judges 13, we began studying about Samson, who judged Israel for 20 years. And there was a lot of Philistine oppression during that period of time. He was focused upon himself, his personal desires for women, food, and revenge. While the 13th chapter, verse 7 says, "You shall be a Nazarite to God from womb to the day of his death," he violated that Nazarite vow frequently. In the 14th chapter, verse 4, we learned that God wanted an occasion against the Philistines. They were the rulers in Israel at the time, and Samson married a Philistine woman. She betrayed Samson. He responded by killing 30 Philistines. He leaves for a while and goes back to see his wife and finds she's been given to someone else, another man. So he finds takes foxes and fire, burns the standing grain, the vineyards, and the groves of the Philistines. That didn't set very well with the Philistines. So attack Israel, or threaten attack. 3,000 men of Judah convinced Samson to surrender. They bind him, turn him over to the Philistines. And the Spirit of the Lord comes upon Samson. He snaps the ropes that bind him, uses a donkey's jawbone to slaughter a bunch of Philistines. At the end of that fight, he was so thirsty, he did pray to the Lord, and the Lord provided water for him. His wife, his wife had been burned by the Philistines along with her father as a part of their revenge against Samson. But he goes finally to a harlot in the Philistine city of Gaza. And the Philistines tried to capture him, but it doesn't work out. He carries the city gates and the posts and the bars about 30 miles uphill toward the mountain near Hebron. That brings us to Judges 16, verse 4, where we meet Delilah, just a wonderful lady who agrees for 1,100 pieces of silver to betray Samson. And several, it appears, Philistine lords offer to provide her that amount of money or silver. And she should be quite wealthy at that point in time. She asks him for the secret to defeating his strength three times, and he lies to her three times. That brings us to Judges, the 16th chapter, about verse 15, where she's going to play the love card. Let's read, and we'll really begin about verse 18 in just a moment. She says, let's see, I've got to display it, don't I? Okay. Then she said to him, "How can you say I love you when your heart is not with me? You have deceived me You have deceived me these three times and have not told me where your great strength is." It came about when she pressed him daily with her words and urged him that his soul was annoyed to death. So he told her all that was in his heart and said to her, "A razor has never come on my head, for I have been a Nazarite to God from my mother's womb. If I'm shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I will become weak and be like any other man." She plays that love card, nags him daily to tell her how to control his great strength. One of the translations says she pressed him daily. The New King James says she pestered him. So he finally speaks of his hair, which under the Nazarite vow should not be cut. That brings us down a little bit further, where he's actually telling her the truth this time. He says, "If I am shaved, then my strength will leave me, and I will become weak and be like any other man." Finally, nagging, pressing, whatever, he answers her. So we all have experienced circumstances similar to that, but when it comes to evil, we need to continue to resist. Beginning in verse 18, when Delilah saw that he had told her all that was in his heart, she sent and called the lords of the Philistines, saying, "Come up once more, for he has told me all that is in his heart." Then the lords of the Philistines came up to her and brought the money in their hands. She made him sleep on her knees and called for a man and had him shave off the seven locks of his hair. Then she began to afflict him, and his strength left him. She said, "The Philistines are up on you, Samson." And he awoke from his sleep and said, "I will go out as at other times and shake myself free." But he did not know that the Lord had departed from him. Then the Philistines seized him and gouged out his eyes, and they brought him down to Gaza and bound him with bronze chains, and he was a grinder in the prison. However, the hair of his head began to grow again after it was shaved off. Delilah perceives Samson has answered her truthfully. She sends a message to the Philistine leaders that they need to pay up. She wants to collect her 1,100 shekels of or pieces of silver from each one. And she's done her part. You'll recall that large sum was mentioned in verse 5. So as verse 18 ends, they bring the money. And then she induces Samson to sleep on her knees and has a servant come in and shave his head. Seven locks of hair are removed. After that, she cries out, tells Samson the Philistines are there. Samson thinks he's going to wake up and defeat the Philistines like he has in the past, but that doesn't work out that way. They're able to capture him. The Philistines seize Samson. They gouge out his eyes. They take him to Gaza. They bind him with bronze chains. They put him to work doing the job of an oxen, grinding the grain. They did make a mistake, though. They didn't pay attention that his hair was growing. Also, notice that Samson's eyes had gotten him into trouble. He used them to look at a Philistine woman who he married, a Philistine harlot, and finally, Delilah. This element of weakness on the part of Samson is no longer part of his existence. His eyes won't get him in trouble this time. What would you like to say through verse 22? In verse 23, "Now the lords of the Philistines assembled to offer a great sacrifice to Dagon their god and to rejoice, for they said, 'Our God has given Samson, our enemy, into our hands.' When the people saw him, they praised their God, for they said, 'Our God has given our enemy into our hands, even the destroyer of our country who has slain many of us.'" Well, as you think about that, about 3,000 Philistines have assembled to offer a great sacrifice to their false god Dagon because they believe their false god has helped them capture Samson. The truth of the matter is, the false god doesn't have any power. But the Philistine people who are assembled seem to agree that Dagon had a part in this. So it so happened when they were in high spirits that they said, "Call for Samson that he may amuse us." So they called for Samson from the prison, and he entertained them. And they made him stand between the pillars. Then Samson said to the boy who was holding his hand, "Let me feel the pillars on which the house rests, that I may lean against them." Now the house was full of men and women, and all the lords of the Philistines were there. You know, those that had offered the 1,100 pieces of silver to Delilah. And about 3,000 men and women were on the roof looking on while Samson was amusing them. That's quite an assembly, isn't it? 3,000 men and women are having a great celebration over the capture of Samson, and now they want to mock him, treat him as a source of amusement. Maybe they tormented him in some manner, since he could not see them coming at him. The verse just says they were entertained. When the verse says they had him stand between two pillars, it seems this was done maybe to provide more of the people the best view. We're not told. And then in verses 26 and 27, with 3,000 men and women elevated up above Samson, Samson has a boy position him where he can feel the pillars holding up the building. He's not amused by their treatment, but they're having a good time. So then Samson called to the Lord and said, "O Lord God, please remember me and please strengthen me just this time, O God, that I may at once be avenged of the Philistines for my two eyes." Samson grasped the two middle pillars on which the house rested and braced himself against them, the one with his right hand, the other with his left. And Samson said, "Let me die with the Philistines." And he bent with all his might so that the house fell on the lords and all the people who were in it. So the dead whom he killed at his death were more than those he killed in his life. First, we see Samson praying for the second time that we have recorded. You'll recall the first time was when he was thirsty and had just killed quite a few Philistines. So here he prays to God to remember him, to give him strength, to allow him to be avenged against the Philistines who had gouged out his eyes. And then Samson now asked to die with his enemies. And his statement, "Let me die with the Philistines," may be a shout of a hero, or take it as you will. He uses his strength to bring that temple down as he kills the Philistines. More Philistines at this time than all of those that we've read about since we started studying about Samson. In many ways, this final act seems to make him a hero finally, because he's finally killed those that worshiping the false god Dagon and who had persecuted him. Any comments to this point? Dale. Great point. We've said over and over the lust for women and his desire for vengeance have gotten him into trouble. Bruce?
Another thing, if you think about it, all the lords here of the Philistines, they were the leader of the Philistines. So he's killed all the leaders, which basically set them back against Israel this time.
Good thought. Anyone else? Then his brothers and all of his father's household came down, took him and brought him up and buried him between Zorah and Eshtaol in the tomb of Manoah's father. Thus he had judged Israel 20 years. He died alone, but he was buried in the family plot because his brothers and father traveled 45 miles roughly to recover the body and take him home to be buried in the tomb of his father. He had judged Israel for 20 years. Pretty good amount of time, but filled with vengeance, as Dale pointed out, and the lust of the eyes, and so on. I'm packed.
You know, I was thinking about
I wish I had talked to you before class in the temples of Karnak and Luxor in Egypt. We saw columns that it would take quite a few people to put their arms around that were built in just that manner. We're going to the 17th through the 21st chapters to finish our study of Judges, and then we'll study Ruth and Esther after that. These last chapters are not necessarily in chronological order. They seem to be included to illustrate the apostasy and lawlessness and immorality and disunity and legalism that is found in that society at that time during the 300 or so years that the judges were present in Israel. As we begin our study of these last chapters of the book of Judges, we're going to see two key points brought out in the 17th and 18th chapters, and that is the religious decline in Israel, as if we haven't seen a lot of it with the judges already, is shown in the 17th chapter by Micah the Ephraimite's idolatry, and in the 18th chapter by the Danites' idolatry. In the 19th and 21st chapters, the moral decline of Israel is going to be presented. In Judges 17, verse 6, we read, "Every man did what was right in his own eyes." In Judges, that's in the 17th chapter. In the 21st chapter, 25th verse, "Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." What would it be like if each of us started behaving in that manner? One writer observed that for pagans to act like pagans is one thing. For the chosen people of God to act like pagans is something altogether different. From a spiritual perspective, the people's lives reveal that they had completely forgotten God. And all the participants in chapters 17 and 18 are Israelites. They had the right heritage, they lived in the right land, used the right language, but they had perverted the very core of their faith. As we study these last chapters of Judges, which involve no foreign oppression or a judge in Israel, let's recognize that real faith can die even when the name of God is on our lips. As we look at these verses, Grant and I have talked about these verses more than once, encourage you to consider, as you think about the Ten Commandments presented here from Exodus 20, whether or not some of these Ten Commandments were broken, such as theft, false witness, dishonoring parents, making a graven image, worshiping idols in a shrine, calling on the Lord's name in a vain manner, and perhaps covetousness for good measure. Let's look at the 17th chapter. "Now there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. He said to his mother, 'The 1,100 pieces of silver which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. I took it.' And his mother said, 'Blessed be my son by the Lord.' He then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, 'I wholly dedicate the silver from my hand to the Lord for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. Now, therefore, I will return them to you.' So when he returned the silver to his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith who made them into a graven image and a molten image. And they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine and he made a ephod and household idols and consecrated one of his sons that he might become his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes." As we start out looking at these verses, in the first three verses we meet Micah, an Ephraimite whose name means "who is like the Lord." As the map shows, Ephraim was north of Judah, south of Manasseh, northwest of the Dead Sea. we immediately learned that his mother had 1,100 pieces of silver, which, one, may indicate family wealth, two, it was stolen from her, and three, she cursed the thief without realizing her son was the thief. The curse also suggests she wants the thief punished. Micah mentions this curse and is likely frightened by his mother's curse, and his fear of the curse might be a reason that he returns the silver. As verse 2 ends, his mother says, "Blessed be my son by the Lord." Maybe that's a way of reversing the curse in her mind. As we look at verse 3, the mother apparently thinks she is performing an action of devotion as she is involved in the making of a graven image, but her son takes the lead. A graven image, let's see, there we go. A graven image refers to idols that are carved or engraved out of wood or stone. And a molten image is made by heating the metal and pouring the liquid into a mold. In verse 4, Micah's mother gives 200 pieces of silver to the silversmith to use to make these idols. Once the idols are made, they become Micah's. An interesting thought here for us to consider is Deuteronomy 17th chapter, verse 15. "Cursed is the man who makes an idol or a molten image, an abomination to the Lord, the work of the hands of the craftsman, and sets it up in secret. And all the people shall answer and say, Amen." In verse 5, it gets worse. "And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and household idols, and consecrated one of his sons, they might become his priest." In addition to what his mother started, Micah has a private shrine. It's a structure for these sacred relics. He had an ephod prepared, and in Exodus 25:7, this was a garment to be worn originally by the high priest. It was a short garment without sleeves and formed a basic article of clothing. Then he had household idols called teraphim in the King James Version and consecrates one of his sons to be a priest. Well, you had the mother that wanted the images made. Then you had Michael. Now you have a son involved. You got three generations involved in this false worship. And then you get to verse 6. "In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes." Seven times in this book we've read a similar statement. This is a total regard of God and his commandments. Interestingly, in Judges, the 18th chapter, 24, we see another indication of how far this idolatry has gone when Micah refers to these items as his gods. That further illustrates how far the apostasy has gone. God should be their recognized leader. No man should be their king, but that's not the direction they're heading, is it? What would you like to say over these first six verses? In verse 7, "Now there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite, and he was staying there. Then the man departed from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to stay wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. Micah said to him, 'Dwell with me,' and he said to them, 'I am,'" I lost my place. "Micah said to him, 'Where do you come from?' And he said to him, 'I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I'm going to stay wherever I may find a place.' Micah then said to him, 'Dwell with me, and be a father and priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your maintenance.' So the Levite went in. The Levites agreed to live with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons." Well, I thought he was going to be a father and priest. "Became like one of his sons." Verse 12, "So Micah consecrated the Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, Now I know that the Lord will prosper me, seeing I have a Levite as priest. So going back to verse 7, we meet a young man from Bethlehem of Judah. Remember, there was another Bethlehem up north, as opposed to Bethlehem of Zebulun. This is saying he's a native of Judah. The Levites were given, 48 cities spread throughout the length and breadth of Israel in which they would live. So this is a Levite whose name might be Jonathan, according to 18th chapter, verse 30, who came from a Levitical city in Judah. In verse 8, we read that although he was staying in Bethlehem of Judah, he's left and started looking for a place to stay and reaches Micah's house in Ephraim. In verse 9, he tells Micah he is looking for a place to stay. So in verse 10, Micah offers him lodging, clothing, and 10 pieces of silver per year with Micah, to live with Micah. In verse 11, the young man agrees to stay with Micah and be part of the family. In verses 12 and 13, Micah treats worship as a private business. As you look at that, he consecrates his own priest. He has his own private shrine to hold the relics, his own ephod for his priest, his own graven idol, his own molten idol. While he may not have ignored the true God entirely, he's chosen to supplement his worship with the barred pagan idols of the area. Verse 13 says he's convinced himself that since he has his own shrine, his own idols, his own priest, the Lord will prosper me. Isn't that sad? That very much reflects the attitudes and feelings of many people in the religious world today. They do what they believe is good and proper in their own sight as a way to honor and worship God. They forget God has established how he wants to be served and worshiped. This was true in the Old Testament days, and it's true in New Testament times in which we live. Micah did not grasp that God is more pleased with obedience than sacrifice. 1 Samuel 15:22, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. That attitude is very similar to what we see today. And as you go on in Isaiah 5:20, woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who substitute darkness for light and light for darkness, who substitute bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and clever in their own eyesight. The book of Judges makes this same point very strongly with the story of Micah. Just because Micah said, I know that the Lord will prosper me, doesn't mean it's going to happen. As we continue our study in the book of Judges, we're going to see this is true. What would you like to say on verses 1 through 13?
Thank you.
when we think about this molten idol and the carved images and so on, do we see any of that type of worship in Bowling Green, Warren County today? I can't tell you how many cathedrals that Linda and I have been in our, some of our travel overseas. But James and Tara were in Salzburg a day or so ago, and they're in, and brought to mind for Linda and I that we went to this monastery. And as we were touring the monastery, there's this image of Mary, and this young priest comes in with black robe, kneels, crosses himself in front of the image, and gets up and goes on his way. We have things of this nature in our community today, and many other religious bodies have similar type issues that they're using in their worship. So this isn't just Old Testament times. This is present. This is something that you go into some of these cathedrals or in some of these church buildings here in our community, you're going to find carved images and so on. Any other comments? Our time is about up. Doug.